From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the entwined relationship between local police in Michigan and the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Service.
There's been a real interest, I would say, for many years by local police in supporting the operations of Customs and Border Protection.
Also, a story from Michigan history about neighbors standing up for each other when slave catchers arrived in town.
We talk about the Underground Railroad, you know, as a big secret thing. It wasn't a secret there.
And one Michigan dermatologist talks to us about protecting your skin from winter sun. Sunscreen, it turns out, is not just for the beach.
Well, it depends on your total exposure, you know, throughout the winter. If you work outdoors, you play outdoors, there's definitely still a risk, especially in the snow reflecting back at us.
Those stories and more coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're going to review some new guidelines for sunscreen. And yes, you do need it sometimes in the winter, talking with a Michigan dermatologist.
And then the rest of the skin, whether it's your face, your hands, those definitely are two areas which typically we're not protecting enough.
That's coming up. But first, we want to revisit one way that federal immigration enforcement has been working. We've been talking a lot lately about immigration and customs enforcement efforts to meet President Trump's goals to deport thousands of people every day. But there's another federal agency that police officers work with and have been for years, Customs and Border Protection, or CBP. If you've ever crossed the border back into the U.S., no doubt you've encountered their agents. Because we're right next to Canada, we're a border state. While several local police agencies in Michigan work with CBP, some question whether local police and these federal agents should be working together so closely, detaining and arresting people regardless of legal status or criminal history. Kobe Levin with Outlier Media in Detroit recently wrote about a woman and her son picked up by Detroit police, then turned over to CBP agents, who ended up jailed in Texas for over a month. Kobe, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Real briefly, can you explain the difference between Customs and Border Patrol and ICE? Because sometimes, admittedly, their names have been used a little bit interchangeably in the fury of the past couple of months of news coverage and just person-to-person conversations.
So they are two different federal agencies. They're both tasked with dealing with immigration law. But Customs and Border Protection is focused on the border, like their name says, and they, in theory, are kind of tied to that and aren't supposed to operate too far, though how far is too far is sometimes a matter of debate. And then ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, operates all across the country enforcing violations of immigration law. Now, they do work closely together. So in the story that we're going to discuss today, you'll see that CBP is handing off folks into ICE detention, ICE custody.
There are a number of police agencies in the Metro Detroit area that have worked with Customs and Border Protection for years. It's not new, right?
This isn't new at all. There's been a real interest, I would say, for many years by local police in supporting the operations of Customs and Border Protection. And the question is, well, what has changed now that immigration enforcement operations are ramped up under the second Trump administration?
Kobe, I understand that we may not have very precise statistics on how this all works and exactly how many people CBP are detaining compared with ICE. But do you have a sense from reporting this story just how prolific CBP has been in forwarding the president's goals to deport people who may not have paperwork on them?
Sure. So in the Detroit area, CBP is an essential cog in the deportation machine. That's because many local police departments in our area, here kind of close to the Canadian border, are in the practice, the regular practice of calling CBP for, maybe they say they need help translating from one language to another, or maybe they want CBP to double check a passport that somebody has handed them. The result of that, though, is that CBP is also taking orders from the Trump administration. It's part of that executive branch in the Department of Homeland Security. And so police who've gotten used to dealing with CBP are effectively passing a large number of folks into ICE custody.
So you recently did some depth reporting on a case in Detroit where a woman and her son ended up spending a month out of state after local officers called Customs and Border Protection on them. Can you explain who this family is and where they were when they were detained?
Sure. So Santiago Zamora is a 17-year-old Detroit high school student, and he was coming home from baseball practice with his mother, Evelyn Perez, when they were stopped by local police in Fraser, Michigan. That's just outside of Detroit. So they're on their way home, and a police officer pulls them over. Santiago was actually driving. His mother wasn't feeling well, and he doesn't have a license. So the police officer stops him for that. But rather than issue a ticket for driving without a license, they saw that Santiago handed over a passport and called Customs and Border Protection. And in less than 24 hours, they were Santiago and his mother were in ICE custody, and they were taken to Texas, that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles away, and held there for more than a month. They missed school, they missed the holidays, they're disconnected from their people. And at the end of the day, they're just going to end up attending the same judicial hearing that they were always planning to attend. So really nothing about their status as asylum seekers has changed. They're still cooperating with the immigration court system the way they were before. But because of this encounter with a local police department, they spent Christmas in prison.
You were able to obtain a video of the initial interactions with police.
All right, stay in the vehicle.
And we hear the officer talking with Santiago and his mom, and then we hear them discussing amongst each other what they should do, whether they should make an arrest.
They're sending an agent, so I'm not going to issue him for Noli. He's a minor, so I'm just going to
get him out of here then, yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
And that's less paperwork for you, yeah.
I'm just going to transfer over.
Okay.
It sounds like the officers felt like they'd be dealing with less paperwork, Kobe, if they called Customs and Border Protection.
Yeah, the officers did say clearly, oh, geez, this is a minor. And so charging him with something like driving without a license would be complicated. And they joked, it would just be easier to call Border Patrol. One officer said, get them out of here. So there's a clear recognition on the part of the officers that Border Patrol is likely to deport people, that they're participating in this machinery of removing people from the country as quickly as possible. And they viewed it as a normal part of their jobs.
Do you think that this case is at all typical, or in your reporting, have you come across other situations that appear to have been handled in a similar way?
Yes. I've been requesting similar records from police departments all across the metro area. We already have gotten quite a few back. And there's a pattern that really mirrors decades of evidence that was amassed by the ACLU in a report a few years ago. For some departments, it is explicit policy that if you encounter somebody who doesn't speak English, you call CBP. So they're still doing that. Traffic stops in the Metro Detroit area are still turning into immigration enforcement opportunities. And that comes down to the policy and practice of our local police.
What do you think that this shows us about how increased enforcement is playing out day by day?
So it basically comes down to police departments that are either willingly or maybe unwittingly contributing to a dramatically changed situation, right? I mean, the backdrop has changed. You can hear the federal agent who comes to pick up Santiago and Evelyn say, you know, I wouldn't have thought that we needed to arrest them, but my supervisor says I have to.
So if it was up to me, I would have been like, well, they have a court date.
Right.
You know, and that's... We have three cells. We have eight men, three cells. They need a cell by themselves now, and one of our shooters took a crap.
That comes down to a change in immigration policy pushed by the Trump administration. And it underscores the simple fact that when a local police officer decides to call CBP today, it is different than it was a year or 2 years ago, because CBP is under orders to much more aggressively deport and detain people. So they are on the ground floor. providing people into a system that is looking to ramp up its numbers as much as possible.
Kobe, there has been some talk at the state level about trying to put guardrails on how ICE enforcement works in Michigan. Are you aware of any efforts to maybe try to at least put some policies and procedures in a little bit more rigorous or austere way about how local officers are interacting with CBP?
I'm not aware of a single municipality that was in the practice or had the policy of calling CBP for this kind of issue and has now stopped. And many times, you know, something like a sanctuary policy may or may not directly address that, right? You really have to get down to brass tacks and, you know, tell officers, well, if you're presented with a passport, for instance, how are you supposed to deal with that? There are a handful of municipalities that that don't require officers to do that, don't seem to have that practice, right? So it does vary. But in terms of a municipality that was in the practice and changed it, I have not seen that. And that includes places where folks are voicing concerns publicly about immigration enforcement, saying it's gone too far. They're concerned about ICE. And yet officers there are still in the regular practice of calling Customs and Border Protection.
I mean, is there any way for folks to know if they're curious whether or not their local sworn officers are working with Customs and Border Protection?
There is. I mean, it's a question for your city council member. You can ask what the policy is. You can ask if it's happened, you know, in the last several months, have police officers called Customs and Border Protection during a traffic stop? You know, that information can be obtained via FOIA. And I encourage folks to go get public records that belong to all of us. But at the end of the day, this is something that's happening in plain sight. And folks should be able to get this information from their elected officials, from the police departments that are working for them, and judge for themselves whether this kind of practice is a good use of their tax dollars.
Kobe Levin reports for Outlier Media, and you can get more information about his recent story about Santiago and his mom at outliermedia.org. Kobe, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's time for us to take a break now. When we return, we'll revisit how the town of Marshall defied federal laws to protect a family in the 1840s.
Very quickly, Black Americans who were living in Marshall came to the Crosswhites' house to confront the enslavers.
You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. At the end of January 1847, a few men from Kentucky arrived in the town of Marshall, Michigan, to recapture, as they put it, a slave. That was legal under the Fugitive Slave Law of 1793. But people in Marshall rallied around their Black neighbors and protected them from capture. It's a story that has particular resonance today as folks in Minneapolis and elsewhere are protesting ICE's crackdown on their cities and their neighbors. Joining us now is Sandra Clark, director of the Michigan History Center. Sandra, welcome back to Stateside.
Glad to be here, April.
Can you set this up for us a bit? These Southern slave catchers coming to Michigan, were they looking for someone specific?
Yes, they were. They were looking for Adam Crosswhite and Sarah Crosswhite and their family, which by then included 5 children. When they had escaped slavery and come to Marshall, they only had 4, but now they had a 5th, a baby, and had been living in Marshall for a few years.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Fugitive Slave Act and how it was used in the courts to justify the search for people who had done so much to attain their freedom?
So under the Fugitive Slave Act, it recognized the right of people to own other people and basically said that you could not aid someone who was escaping slavery and prevent their return to their so-called owners. Usually there was a big attempt at immediately after the escape from slavery to capture people, but during this late 1840s period, there are several examples in Michigan, 2 big ones, and this is one of them, of a very deliberate effort by people coming up from Kentucky to attempt to capture people who had escaped servitude.
Well, getting back to the Crosswhites, can you tell us about what kind of reception Adam and Sarah and their children found in the 1840s when they first arrived in Marshall?
Well, they found a very welcoming reception. There were other African Americans there, quite possibly some others who had escaped from enslavement in Kentucky or nearby places. And they found a community that had a lot of people who were willing to help fugitives from slavery. That was true, Battle Creek, Marshall, that whole area. We talk about the Underground Railroad, you know, as a big secret thing. It wasn't a secret there. It was public. It was known who the people were who were working to help fugitives from slavery. And they were very proud of what they were doing and very open about it.
What did they do to try to bring the Crosswhites in?
Well, the leader of the group, the nephew of the former enslaver of the Crosswhites, had really scouted out Marshall pretty well. So they knew that they were likely to receive some opposition to what they were trying to do. And so in the early morning hours before sunrise, they came to the house, they knocked on the door. Crosswhites didn't open it, they kicked in the door. And there's two stories. One, that Crosswhite fired a gun, which was a prearranged signal because people knew that this was a potential thing to have happen. Or one of the children ran into town to tell other people what was going on. But very quickly, Black Americans who were living in Marshall came to the Crosswhites' house to confront the enslavers.
I read that banker Charles T. Gorham arrived also, that it was not just the black citizens of Marshall who came. Can you explain what all these people gathered together did to try to help the Crosswhites?
So the black citizens do arrive earlier, but Gorham is one of the later white arrivals. They basically threaten and tell people they can't take them, but then the sheriff comes. And since they had broken down the door of the house to get in, he arrests them for breaking down the door and for assault and battery.
Wow.
And they take them to the town jail, and they have a quick little trial of them so they can hold them, which, of course, buys time for the Crosswhites to leave.
Oh. Did they go farther north then?
No. Actually, they hid outside of town for a while, and then they took them on to Jackson, Michigan. The Michigan Central Railroad runs through Marshall and Jackson by this time. But they went to Jackson. Someone from Marshall got on the train to make sure that there were none of Troutman's compatriots or anything in trouble on the train. So when the train pulled into Jackson, he signaled that it's okay. They got on the train, went to Detroit. George DeBaptiste, one of our Underground Railroad African Americans in Michigan that did a lot of work, helped them get across the river to Canada. And once in Canada, they settled in and bought some property. They do show up in the Canadian census.
So Francis Giltner decides to sue this banker, Charles Gorham, and some of the other citizens in town who intervened for the value of the people that he saw as his property. And he won. In court, he was awarded $4,800, which I have to say, in 1840s money sounds like a pretty huge sum. Would you say it was substantial?
Oh, yes. It was a very large sum. And in fact, there were efforts at fundraising to pay off that charge because of it. It was so much. And Giltner was the person that really had to do that. Some of the other people who were charged did not have resources that they could have contributed to that. The other thing that's interesting, there's actually two trials. The first one is a hung jury because someone wouldn't vote to convict. And for the second one, Adam Crosswhite comes back to testify for the defense. And he manages to come in to testify and then to go back to Canada.
What became of the Crosswhites? Did they live out their lives in Canada?
No, they come back to Michigan. They're back in Marshall by the 1870 census. We don't know exactly when they came back. Both Adam and we believe Sarah lived there until their deaths. There is a Adam Crosswhite. We know where his grave is. And one of our researchers recently found that there is a grave in the cemetery for a Sadie Crosswhite, which we think is the nickname of Sarah. So we believe they're both buried there. One of their sons, Benjamin, is buried in Marshall. So their tie to Marshall was a pretty tight tie.
Yeah. This is such an amazing story. I'm guessing that reactions from the people in Marshall may or may not have been replicated in other places in Michigan. Do you have any sense of whether neighbors stood up for others in other towns before the Civil War, when the Fugitive Slave Act was in effect?
Oh, yes. There are many, many cases. And there's a very early one, the Blackburns in Detroit, where some call it the first Detroit riot. It's a wonderful case where some women come in to visit the woman who had been in that case, was in jail waiting to be sent back south. And they changed clothes. She left and went to Canada. The next morning, there was a huge crowd, and they basically rescued her husband, and he made it to Canada. And their case is the one where Canada came up with the legal position that they would not extradite someone whose crime in the United States was not something that they would be punished for in Canada. Canada is part of the British Empire then. It's not the nation we know now. But so that's a very important one. There's another one around the same time over in Battle Creek, which involves people actually down in Cass County who are working on some Quaker farms, and a whole group of Kentuckians come up to take them back. Kind of the same kind of story. They arrest the Kentuckians for a while, the people disappear. There's a wonderful story. The Hussies in Battle Creek are known workers on the Underground Railroad. They're very public about it. And there's a reminiscence of their daughter when she was 16 and her parents were away. And she heard some people at the back door and knew it was fugitives from slavery. And since her mom and dad weren't home, she went over to the around the neighbors so that they could get food and everything away before they had to go on to the next stop. That says that there is a public in Michigan, not everybody by any means, but there's a public in Michigan that is very willing at this point in time to help fugitives from slavery.
Sandra Clark is director of the Michigan History Center. Sandra, thank you for sharing this story with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's a wonderful story, and we all need to remember it.
Boy, are we getting a winter this year. After several years in which climate change left us with relatively long slowness stretches with warm-ish temperatures and less lake ice than we traditionally had in Michigan, this one sure got cold and stayed cold. For some, the wintry weather has not been fun. However, for other Michiganders, these conditions have been perfect. For winter celebrations, they've actually had to cancel the past few years because it was just too warm. Think about people who delight in snowshoeing and snowmobiling and ice fishing. And here's an ultimate case in point, the 74th annual tip-up on the Devils and Round Lake in the Irish Hills near the bottom of the Lower Peninsula in Lenawee County. It's taking place this weekend, Friday, February 6th through Sunday the 8th. And with us now is the Ice Queen herself, Jackie Borton, Secretary of the Devils and Round Lake Men's Club, the organization hosting the tip-up. Hey, Jackie, welcome.
Oh, thank you, April. How are you?
Well, I'm just fine. Before we get into the tip-up, can you maybe tell us about the Devil's Lake historic connection to ice?
Sure. The Devil's Lake is actually in Manitow Beach in Lenawee County. And back in the late 1800s, in the early 20th century, there was an ice company that actually harvested ice and shipped it to Detroit. This was a time, you know, before we had refrigeration technology. And so they had ice houses that they built on the shores of the lake to store the ice, and they shipped it out.
I mean, it may seem like a funny commodity now, but only if you have access to air conditioning, I suppose, right?
Right. And it was really cool. About, I don't know, 8-10 years ago on Round Lake, I actually witnessed the local Amish group harvesting ice using their horses and ice saws and ice tongs. It was really interesting to watch it all take place.
Wow. So this tip up has been going on for a long time now, 74 years. Have you spoken with people who, you know, have historic connections, have been going to this for a long time?
I haven't. And most of them say, well, it's not like the good old days. And I don't know, maybe because rules and regulations have come in, now we have to make sure that the DNR is happy with what we're doing. We have to put race lanes for the snowmobiles. We just have to make people safe. So things have changed a lot. But people used to come out and get their snowmobiles out. They had some type of airboat that they used on ice. And of course, then they did ice fishing too.
Jackie, what the heck is a tip up?
It's a fishing device. There's a wire attached to a fishing rod, and when this fishing rod is tripped from the fish getting onto the bait, a flag pops up. So it tips up so that they know they have a fish on line. So that's pretty much it. I think it all really started for, you know, people to come out and ice fish. And I was confused at first. I thought it had something to do with like maybe tipping up a beverage or something. I really was confused.
I mean, if you've got a flask on you or a thermos. A thermos, yes.
A thermos of coffee, even. Yeah, you're tipping up something. Yeah, so it is actually a fishing term. And that is the big thing. We have a tournament going all weekend. It's a free tournament. Of course, you need your Michigan fishing license, but we have a fishing board up, and they give prizes for, well, there's 5 species of fish that they'll take and put on our fishing board so that we can give prizes for the largest fish caught on Devils or Round Lake.
How thick is the ice at current?
There's varying levels around the lake. I'd say the average is 9 inches. We have a group from our Devils Around Lake Men's Club going out today to check the ice condition to make sure that it is safe for do. We have a red light ride that we do Friday night to kick it off. And so they're going to make sure that it is safe for everybody to be out there. But most people are saying 9 inches.
There are pictures from the past where people drive their cars out onto the ice. Is that still a thing?
Well, we're trying to discourage that right now, only because the ice technically is not thick enough for a vehicle to be out there. Now, a four-wheeler, yes, a side-by-side, snowmobiles, and on foot. I've done it. It's kind of freaky to walk on the lake, but we really are trying to discourage people from taking their trucks out there.
Are most of the people who take part in this folks who live in the Irish Hills?
I'd say most of them, but, you know, I have some friends coming from St. Clair Shores and some from Coldwater. And then we have a lot of people who come to Devil's Lake area because they are from Ohio, but they have a summer or seasonal home at the lake. So it covers quite a few different areas of people, really.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how the competition works? I mean, is the idea to just catch the biggest fish you can or the most fish?
It's we have 5 categories that we have people catch fish. There's pike, walleye, bluegill, crappie, and perch. And they bring the biggest fish they catch. And again, like I said, it's free. And then they post it on the fish board so people can come around and see who's caught what fish. And then Sunday at noon, we give out prizes. We have cash prizes that the Lakes Preservation League donates to us. And then a couple other vendors in the area give us prizes too. So it's a free contest. Just catch the biggest fish. It's not the most fish. It's the biggest fish.
Jackie, as we mentioned earlier, this is a good year for the tip up in terms of weather conditions. But what kinds of things have you had to do in the past when winter weather wasn't playing ball?
Oh, it's been tough a couple of years. We even had a couple of years ago, we had to cancel, I should say, the fishing tournament because there wasn't even enough ice for the fishermen to go out. But we do have a poker run that takes place so people can go by car. And the local restaurants and bars put on different events within their place to attract people too, because that's the whole idea of how we started Tip Up.
because it's always kind of slow in the winter months, was to attract people to the Devils and Round Lake area to help the businesses make it through the tough winter months.
Do you have a personal pitch for someone who's never been out for this event before about why they should come check out Tip Up this weekend?
Well, I guess probably based on the first time I was there and I found out how much was going on, I was amazed at how big the fish were that came out of the lake. And I've swam in those lakes. That kind of made me nervous. And then we do have free hovercraft rides offered up. So whether you have snow or ice, and it's just fun to see the locals and look at everybody in their snow bunny suits and see the old snowmobiles that come out. And we do have an auction that we end the weekend with. It's a fundraising auction, which we've received so many wonderful donations, and it just helps us support our community events by having this auction. So it's just kind of fun to come out and see what's going on in the lake and get out of the house and blow some dust off and have some fun on the ice.
Jackie Borton, secretary of the Devils and Round Lake Men's Club, which, of course, these days makes room for the ladies as well. Jackie, thank you so much for telling us about Tip Up. We appreciate it.
Oh, I really appreciate you reaching out to us. Thank you, April.
We're going to take a short break now. After that, new ideas for old smartphones.
Modern technologies, the way we move around, the way our military is able to defend our country is based on essentially access to these minerals.
That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Your smartphone, the MRI machine at the hospital, precision-guided missiles. These are just a few of the modern technologies that share small but vital components, so-called critical minerals. Currently, China has a near monopoly on the entire supply chain for most of them. What if we were able to get these minerals another way, by recycling our old devices? As Michigan Public's Sarah Swick reports, that idea is already a reality in Michigan and other places, but it's not as straightforward as it sounds.
Think back to your high school chemistry class and the periodic table. 60 of those little boxes represent what the U.S. government has named critical minerals. The government says they're strategically important, and it says the most critical of all the critical minerals are the so-called rare earth elements. Abigail Hunter is an executive director with SAFE, a nonprofit focused on U.S. energy and supply chain security. She says rare earth elements are tiny, but have tremendously powerful magnetic properties, which makes them key components in everything from consumer electronics to military hardware.
Modern technologies, the way we move around, the way our military is able to defend our country is based on essentially access to these minerals.
But there's a problem. China controls most everything from mining and refining rare earth minerals to making those vital magnets. That means that if China restricts critical mineral exports, as indeed they have within the past year, it spells major trouble for the U.S. economy and national security, and that worries a lot of the country's lawmakers. Michigan Congresswoman Haley Stevens is one of them. The Oakland County Democrat says the U.S. needs to do for critical minerals what it did for semiconductors and microchips under the Biden administration, make some big moves to bring that supply chain back on shore.
And that's what I want to see with critical minerals. We cannot and should not be at the mercy of China.
Stevens says that's why she introduced legislation to grow processing and refining capacity in Michigan and the U.S. But what about all those smartphones and other products we have with critical minerals already in them? Couldn't recycling them help us at least get partway toward reducing our dependence on China? Stevens' answer to that question is a resounding yes. But, she adds,
this isn't necessarily 20th century recyclability. These are more complex processes.
At Service Solutions facility here in Wixom, a warehouse worker in gloves and safety glasses sorts regular household batteries into boxes. Spokesperson Danielle Spalding says Service started about 35 years ago in Michigan and has since spread across six states. She says their customers run the gamut.
All major automotive OEMs, battery manufacturers. We partner with healthcare, telecommunications, and municipalities.
Spalding says Serba is doing exactly the kind of thing Stevens is talking about. She uses lithium-ion batteries, the type that power electric vehicles, as an example of what that process looks like. First, the battery gets shredded. Then its component materials are separated out. Then comes a chemical leaching process, which yields what we're really after, something called black mass.
Which is where that beautiful cathode part, where the critical minerals lie within the battery, comes out.
Spalding says Serbo was the first in the country to produce black mass on a commercial scale, and has received several U.S. Department of Energy grants for it. For now, at least, there's no sense that recycling can totally replace mining for new critical mineral supplies. But Spalding says there's hope to create more closed-loop supply chains for batteries used in, say, the new data centers that help power artificial intelligence.
And that way we can ensure that those materials that they're producing out will be able to be used over and over and over again.
But there are some complications. Rare earth metals usually make up very, very small parts of much larger products. And the magnetism that makes them so valuable also makes separating them out a painstaking process, all to yield just a tiny amount. So many recyclers choose to forego that. All of this will be a focus of high-level conversation in Washington, D.C. this week. The U.S. is hosting a critical minerals summit, with representatives from other countries also looking to break China's grip on that supply chain. For Michigan Public, I'm Sarah Swick.
Sure, you may think you're good at taking care of your skin, but do you wear sunscreen in the winter? How about indoors when your desk is next to a window? It's true that your skin deserves protection all year round, and we've invited someone who knows the science to walk us through some winter protection recommendations. We're also going to talk about a sunscreen ingredient you probably have not used, bemetrizinol. Commonly used in other countries, the federal government is permitting it now for U.S. use. Dr. Jeffrey Potts is an associate professor of dermatology with Wayne State School of Medicine. Dr. Potts, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I guess I always assumed, perhaps wrongly, that because I live in a place that's gray and freezing 6 months out of the year, I didn't really have to worry about sunscreen from October to May. I take it that is no longer agreed to be the case?
Well, it depends on your total exposure, you know, throughout the winter. If you work outdoors, you play outdoors, there's definitely still a risk, especially in the snow, reflecting back at us.
How long had the FDA been working on this guidance?
Seems like it's been quite a while. They tried to make some changes in 2021, and really we didn't get any new products available on the market after that. And the last new product we've had for sunscreen is 1999. So it'll be good. Hopefully in the next year, we have another chemical that we're able to use for sunscreen that's safe and effective in other countries, but hasn't been approved here in the U.S.
That's crazy. Can we maybe at this point just take a minute to review what happens to our skin when sun exposure happens for more than, say, a minute or two at a time?
So our skin's supposed to protect against UV damage, and that causes mutations in the keratinocytes, which are skin cells, and our melanocytes, which create pigment in the skin, try to counteract that. And some of us have darker skin types than others. However, even our darkest skin types don't fully protect against that UV damage. And patients with darker skin types can also have aging of the skin, pigmentation of the skin, and UV damage can cause sunburn. It can cause dark spots on the skin. It can cause wrinkles. And we also see cataracts, you know, if it affects the eye as well. Mm. So long-term sun exposure causes a lot of these changes. Short-term, you may have some redness, and then you get tanning from the sun.
Can you give us a sense of what you see as the most significant changes in the FDA's guidance?
So many of the issues with the sunscreen chemicals are they're manufactured in other countries. Some of these companies are doing the science to see what chemicals might be protective against the sun. But other countries, for example, in the EU and Europe, they ban animal testing. So the FDA mandates animal testing for all sunscreens. So we're at an impasse here where we need to look at the science and see what's safe and effective. But we'll never see some of these chemicals because the companies aren't going to do separate testing to be able to meet the criteria because they think it's unethical to do animal testing. So with the new changes, we're hoping that we can look at observational data, real-world data, and many of these chemicals have been used for quite a while now to see what's safe and effective that the FDA can then approve and hopefully be able to see here at the U.S. market.
Is there anything that people should know that's changed in the, you know, the frequency or the manner that the FDA suggests that we use these products, no matter what they may be made from?
So in terms of the frequency of use, you know, they are approved to use daily for some of these, you know, whether they're chemical sunscreens or what we call inorganic or mineral sunscreens. At this point, the only GRACE, G-R-A-S-E, which is generally recognized as safe and effective sunscreens, are mineral sunscreens. So we have zinc oxide and titanium dioxide. All the other chemical sunscreens are not meeting that criteria. And it seems at this point, there's still a lot of question marks with these chemicals that do absorb into our blood. And it's not really clear what long-term effects they do have. So the only ones we know don't get into our blood are going to be the zinc and titanium. Not to say that chemical sunscreens are not safe. It's just that we don't know for certain. So the ones that are for certain safe, they've called them GRACE at this point.
So if I'm someone who does a lot of outdoor snow removal, you know, professionally, or, you know, maybe drives in conditions that might be very sunny in the winter, or if I hunt or ski or fish, it's pretty clear from not just this guidance, but other kinds of guidance that sunscreen is needed. What are your concerns about people who aren't outside that much? Maybe people who work in school or hospital settings or offices or factories that don't have a lot of windows.
Yeah, windows are still a thing. You know, the UV exposure, and even we know natural light, even from LEDs and fluorescent bulbs, can cause aging in the skin if we have a darker skin type. So that is a risk as well. So having that photo protection on indoors does help them also. If you're traveling to work, you have to get there somehow. You're still getting it from your side windows, because those actually don't protect, you know, against all the UV rays unless you have a special film on them. Our front glass does protect against UV, but not the side glass. So special films, which can be clear, it doesn't have to be darkly tinted, so you don't get pulled over, you know, for having too much of a tint. You can get clear glass coverage on the sides. If you have exposed areas of the skin, the other options are clothing. You know, you can have UPF clothing that protects against sun damage. You don't have to apply sunscreen under those areas, but sunglasses also help, you know, in terms of exposure to your eyes for cataracts and damage that you can have on the eyes. And then the rest of the skin, whether it's your face, your hands, those definitely are two areas which typically we're not protecting enough.
Can I ask how you're feeling about the fact that there might be reduced barriers to getting over-the-counter sunscreens approved more rapidly? Is that something you feel comfortable with as an MD?
Yeah, we have to look at what's approved about these different chemicals. You know, many of these are not new. You know, they've been approved in Europe for many years now. And we have to look at what these chemicals are, what their protection factor is, and look at the risk and benefit. You know, less skin cancer, less aging of the skin, you know, other protection, versus what any potential risks are that we're seeing in the population. If we show that they're recognized as safe and effective, I don't have any concern with, you know, having them get approved and out to market.
Okay, so here's the big question. When you are standing in a drugstore or supermarket in front of the display of 80 kinds of sunscreen, how would you, as a dermatologist, counsel us until we get to the point when some of these other products are coming at us, or as we're seeing new products come onto the market? What are some things that you would want people to keep in mind?
Sure. It's definitely overwhelming with how many options there are, and there's lots of marketing out there and things that don't really mean what they really are saying. So couple tips. You want to look for sun protection factor 30 or above that's proven to protect against skin cancer, because in the real world, most people don't apply enough, you know, to be able to actually get that SPF. You also don't want to spend too much on something that's saying 50 plus, you know, maybe doesn't make a huge difference, you know, so definitely applying it thick enough, applying it often enough. If you are toweling dry, if your skin's getting wet, you can definitely remove a lot of that protection, and you have to reapply it every couple hours. And then I like to suggest mineral sunscreens. If they say that, that means there's zinc and titanium in there. But you also have to look. There may be other filters like chemical sunscreens in there as well. And if it says broad spectrum, that's another thing you want to look for, because it'll protect both against UVA and UVB. And if you have a darker skin type, you might consider getting a tinted sunscreen, which also protects against some of that visible light that I was mentioning can cause sun aging or photo aging, even from indoor light. It'll be a little bit less white and chalky as well. So that's definitely helpful cosmetically.
I'm interested to hear you say that most of us don't apply enough sunscreen or apply often enough. I understand that some of this may depend on what kinds of activities you're doing, especially in the winter. But what seems both realistic and helpful to you?
Yeah, first thing in the morning. And we do have some people that keep it in their cars, which can be an issue with the cold in the winter and can be an issue with the summer, you know, if it's on the opposite end. But keep, you know, small samples with you, like travel size of a product. You can reapply it before you go out, you know, in the afternoon if you're going out for lunch, which in the winter it's a little bit tough. But if you're going to be out for a more prolonged period of time, more than 15 minutes, it's suggested to reapply.
You know, do you have any guidance? You mentioned the fact that, you know, a lot of the effective products that we have include zinc and, you know, other mineral products that may include like a white sort of chalky feel to it. Do you have any advice when I'm admonishing my 15-year-old that she really does need to use sunscreen and use enough that it may actually turn her skin a little bit paler?
Yeah, there's a balance there. You know, something's better than nothing. And you have to look at the risk and, you know, what they're willing to use. Because if it is too white and chalky, somebody's not going to use it and you get no protection. So applying a thick enough layer, you know, is the most important thing of using something that cosmetically is more elegant that they're willing to use. And you just have to try different products. You know, if you see your dermatologist, we'll give you tons of samples. You can pick and choose what you like the best and go from there. Or getting small travel sizes, as I mentioned, you know, can be a good way to try something without getting the big bottle.
I guess the upside of this is that the cosmetic industry has gotten way more into moisturizers and, you know, cosmetic foundations that have a little SPF in them. So,
yep. Certainly, if it's a one-stop shop, you know, that's going to be better than not doing anything at all.
Anything else I missed that you want people to know?
Yeah, definitely. If you have concerns, if you are high risk for skin cancer, this is the best way to protect yourself. And if you have any concerns of your skin, you know, see your local dermatologist. That way we can help you along the road.
Dr. Jeffrey Potts, who practices at Wayne Health and is also the Associate Program Director of Wayne State's Dermatology Residency. Dr. Potts, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
We have received a lot of messages about our recent episodes of On Hand, about the history of the word ope, and also about Michigan accents, including this voice memo from a listener named TJ.
As I sit out in my car waiting for my kids to get off the bus, I just wanted to bring up and ask why it is, with all the talk you've had about our Michigan accents, different words we say differently than other people, other states, how come, and I've already given an example of it, why do we use the word fur instead of the word for? If you listen to any average conversation from different people, see if you notice it a little bit more. Like I said earlier, I'm waiting out in my car for my kids. I didn't say for my kids. Food for thought.
We're here for all your Michigan accent thoughts. Thank you, TJ. TJ sent in his comment through our website, michiganpublic.org/onhand. You can also leave your voice recorded notes for us there, or submit a Michigan question for us to consider in an upcoming episode of On Hand. The next one is all about the state bird, the robin. Got some stories about robins in your backyard? Maybe one nesting on your house or an injured robin you rescued? Maybe you're one of those who think the robin is not the bird to represent our state. What's your bird story that better captures Michigan's whole relationship with birds? Send us your thoughts and stories. michiganpublic.org/onhand. That's it for Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, Ronia Kapansug, Michelle Jokish-Polo, and by April Van Buren. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber Davis. Our interns are Astrid Code, Eleanor Epperson, and Maximilian Resch. Stateside is a production of Michigan Public. Find out more at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. We'll catch you again tomorrow. Till then, take care.